From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Education reform is a great goal. But we'll hear from one reformer who says reform hasn't always lived up to its promise. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to relax restrictions on craft distilleries. They're hearing praise from distillers themselves. One of the most controversial bills in this year's General Assembly involves sheriffs and federal immigration enforcement. You'll learn what lawmakers propose. You'll also hear from critics. And we'll delve into one of the chief roadblocks to a new state budget, Medicaid expansion. Governor Cooper wants it. Lawmakers disagree. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
A new poll from the Civitas Institute shows North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper with a solid lead over his presumptive Republican opponent, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, 47-37%. Yet, Governor Cooper's job approval sits at just 40% in a poll from the Democratic polling firm of Public Policy Polling. So what does it all mean when it comes to what we can expect for the governor's race? Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He has been following these polls closely and joins us now. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
What do you make of the results of these two different polls that appear to show something a little bit different for Governor Cooper?
Well, for Governor Cooper, his approval rating is being under 50%, and also the fact that in a head-to-head race with the only announced candidate on the Republican side, him being under 50% suggests that this race is not locked up for Governor Cooper. The problem that Governor Cooper faces is that he seems to be running more against the General Assembly than against his presumptive opponent. And so because there has been so little cooperation with the General Assembly on some major issues, then the voters have to say, well, you know what? Do we like what the General Assembly's doing? Could Governor Cooper be more proactive in his outreach to the General Assembly and to not only to Republican voters, but to unaffiliated voters who comprise the second largest number of voters in North Carolina? So it seems as if both Governor Cooper and Lieutenant Governor Forrest are running to their bases, and that has happened recently in a speech that Lieutenant Governor gave at a church in the Charlotte area. I mean, it's a base election so far, and the base, if you add the base up together of both parties, doesn't add up to nearly 100%.
And we are just talking about Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest here on the show, simply because the pollsters at this point are polling his name.
Right.
Now, filing is a long way off, and there's been some scuttlebutt that there might be other people get into the Republican race for the nomination. What, Rick, do you think is Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest's biggest challenge?
Two things. Number one, can he appeal to unaffiliated voters, voters who are not loyal Republicans, and to voters who are not cultural conservatives? Because
he's very vocal about being a social conservative as well as an economic conservative.
He has been. I mean, the Lieutenant Governor is not ashamed in any way or shy about his faith, and he has made that part of his part of his persona throughout, and part of the way that he's governed, and the way that he's not bashful about it. And so what you see is what you get with him. So that's something that that he has certainly been a part of him throughout. What's sort of looming that may have an impact on his ability to break through is the fact that this continuing fundraising scandal involving insurance operative Greg Lindbergh from Durham looks like it's not going to go away anytime soon. And Mr. Lindbergh is essentially accused of setting up something like a Ponzi scheme to build insurance companies through assets that from other insurance companies that he owned, accumulating this sort of thing. He became a huge donor to both Republicans and Democrats in the insurance commissioner's race to try to get what looked to be favorable treatment, allegedly, from the Department of Insurance. And while Wayne Goodwin, the current Democratic Party chairman, was insurance commissioner when this all started, Wayne Goodwin has largely escaped any problems. Dan Forrest is the one who seems to be in some peril simply because he was involved in a 501c4, an advocacy organization, did some work for that organization, did some endorsement work for that organization that Mr. Lindbergh basically bankrolled. And so it's going to be a difficult needle for him to thread to say, no, I didn't know exactly what was going on with Mr. Lindbergh's business, but I was happy to talk about the issues that were important to him.
Likely to have to face questions about that as we get closer and closer to an election. Again, if we presume that the lieutenant governor will be the Republican nominee. The lieutenant governor is known, Rick, for having all sorts of grassroots connections. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of traveling, talks to a lot of local Republican and conservative groups. What about for Governor Cooper on that score? Do we know if he has those deep roots across the state? We know he's from the eastern part of the state. Well-known there. But does he have that grassroots activism that will turn out for him no matter what?
He didn't really have it so much when he ran the first time. And one of the issues that he has faced through his early political career was that he didn't really have any challenges after he won his first race for attorney general back in 2000, which was somewhat controversial. So we've talked about on this program before with the race that he had against Dan Boyce, Republican. But the issue that he's had throughout is how deep are his ties with local precinct chairs and local and county party officials and things like that. I think he's done a lot to build that up as governor. But are those ties deep enough, longstanding enough to get people to come out who just aren't going to come out and just vote for any Democrat who's on the ballot regardless? So that's the issue, is one of enthusiasm. I think that the Democratic Party statewide is pretty energized right now. And so the governor has that going for him. But it is, again, there's an awful lot you've got to do as running a statewide race, which Dan Forrest has done very well twice now, in getting people to say, we're going to put out yard signs, we're going to go door to door for you, we're going to do all these sorts of things that convince people who otherwise might say him on election day or who might not fill out an absentee ballot and send it in to do those things. And the lieutenant governor is great at that sort of thing. He's a relentless campaigner and a very effective one. And it's yet to be seen how good Governor Cooper will be against someone with that level of talent as a campaigner.
Now, of course, 2020, not only a big-time governor's race for us, we've got a big-time Senate race mm-hmm. on the ballot, and it's a presidential year. And speaking of the president, are we expecting him to come into the state, and do you think that he could in any way impact the outcome of the governor's race?
I would imagine that he would have an impact on that because, first of all, he's already endorsed the incumbent U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, who's running for re-election. So that's already happened. We would imagine he would come into the state. His daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, is a resident of or a native of North Carolina.
Wilmington area, I believe.
And lives and actually has a home in the Wilmington area still. And so she's in the state quite a bit. So we may well see the president, family members, other surrogates in here a lot campaigning. And it may well be that, yes, we'll see that it would have an impact on the governor's race. Of course, we do have the Republican National Presidential Nominating Convention in Charlotte. So he'll be in town for that, of course. But we may see a lot of that. We may see a lot of the vice president, Mike Pence, here in the state as well. North Carolina is going to be as important a state to both parties in 2020 as it was in 2016. And especially with other things going on, such as redistricting, reapportionment, we're probably going to gain at least one congressional seat. It's going to be big. And so the national parties are going to play a lot of role here.
And it's going to be fascinating to see if visits by the president, the vice president, the Trump family, whether or not that generates turnout on the Republican side. Some people believe it will have a positive effect for Republicans. Other people believe that it will help to energize the Democratic base, which, of course, wants to see Donald Trump defeated in 2020. So a lot to come here in North Carolina. Carolina Journal, of course, will be following all of these key races. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Education reform sounds like a great idea. Who could object to improving education, building better schools? But education reform in practice leaves some observers underwhelmed. Count among them Robert Pondicio, senior fellow at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, education reform, you've actually written a whole column on this talk about education reform sort of losing its way. What do you mean by
that? Yeah, I feel like I've written almost nothing but this in the last year or so. I feel like I'm becoming a bit of a broken record. I mean, let me preface this by saying, look, I consider myself an ed reformer, or at least I hope my reform credentials are in good order. I like, you know, choice and charters and accountability and testing just fine. But at the end of the day, I'm also a teacher. That's really how I kind of self-identify, as it were, in this work. I tend to be the guy when those conversations happen about choice and charters and accountability and teacher quality. I say, can we talk about what the kids are doing all day? Because that matters too. And I think that gets a little bit lost in education conversations. I'm going to answer your question soon, but it's discursive. If you think about the logic of the classic ed reform playbook in test-driven accountability, that the notion that's predicated on, right, is that, well, schools know what to do. We only need to hold them accountable for doing it. That's why we test. And if you're good, then we let you open more charters, or we praise you, or we reward you. And if you're no good, then we shut you down or counsel you out of the business. Makes sense, right? Well, because I've been a teacher for so long, I tend to say, wait a minute, where'd you get this idea that we know what to do and we just need to either have our butts kicked or be praised and rewarded for doing it? That's not what's going on inside of a lot of schools. So there's an internal logic problem there. And I think, you know, 20, 25 years into this ed reform experiment, I don't want to be, you know, painted with too broad of a brush, but I think it's been a mixed bag. I mean, I'm an inner city school teacher. That's my background. I'd much rather be a low income kid of color in a place like Newark or New Orleans or New York City, where I've taught today, than 30 years ago. But that's not the same thing as education reform has created this rising tide that has lifted all boats. It has been a very mixed blessing. And a lot of parents complain about the deleterious effects of testing and test prep and accountability. And they're not wrong. So that's in sum, I gave you a complicated answer because it's a complicated issue.
Yeah, it's one of the problems that people latch on to these various reforms and think, well, if we just do this, this is going to work.
And where's that easy button? Yeah. I know it's around here somewhere.
Exactly. Right. So is that something that's hard to help people surmount, that you can't just say more charter schools, more choice, more testing? There needs to be follow-up, and it's not easy.
Well, it's the reason I tend to focus in the work and writing that I do on educational practice. In other words, what curriculum, pedagogy, what are kids doing all day? Because, again, accountability works when that works. So, you know, at the risk of painting with too broad of a brush, my lament is that if we'd spent the last 20 or 30 years trying to improve teaching and learning, educational practice, we'd probably be a little bit further along than we are right now.
We are chatting with Robert Pondicio, who is a senior fellow at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. So you've identified a problem with the reform itself. What do we do now? What do we so if we see this, what do we do?
How much time do we have? I do think that and let me, you know, lest I give the impression that I'm anti-reform, I'm not. I'm, you know, again, my credentials are in good order. But I think it's a question of where we focus our energies. Again, the unambiguous success of ed reform so far are inner city charter schools. But that's not the same thing, again, as having created a rising tide. So if we focus on teaching and learning, on if that really good burst of energy, because that's been an unambiguous good thing, you know, the amount of airtime, so to speak, that we're giving to education, you know, going back to Teach for America and charter schools and whatnot, that's a very good thing. If we had applied that energy that we put into testing and accountability into improving curriculum and instruction, training teachers better, giving them the why, so to speak, as to what we're doing, I think we would be further along. So it's not a question of, you know, policy doesn't matter, accountability doesn't matter. It's you have to be very, very careful about what you're incentivizing, and you have to be very clear on the fact that if teachers, and this is going to sound like I'm being an apologist for bad teaching, I'm not. If you're under the impression that teachers know what to do, you're mistaken. You know, it's one of the first, I was a mid-career switcher. I started teaching at age almost 40. So I was untainted by ed school and, you know, progressive notions of educational practice. And it was a bit of a mystery to me. Like, this is not how I learn, but what do I know? Haven't been in an elementary school since I was a student. So they must know something. It took me a long time to really gain an appreciation for how little, and not because people are poorly intended, just because we have some unusual notions about what good teaching and learning looks like. And much of the energy in the reform movement has not been on that at all. It's been about testing and accountability, et cetera. So, you know, and again, I'm ranting here, but my point is that if we spend that energy trying to improve the product as opposed to assuming the product is fine and now we just need to measure the output, we'd be further along.
Where does the type of reform that you're focusing on work best?
Inside my head.
Yes. Other than inside your head.
Right.
I'm guessing this is not going to be something that Washington is going to dictate to everyone.
No.
Is it something more appropriate at local level, state level?
Sure.
Where?
Sure. Look, I'm not even sure there's a policy play here, if I'm going to be brutally honest about it. I can point to a lot of examples of where policy, as well intended as it might be, has really gotten in the way. Maybe a subject for another time, but we could look at literacy and the incentives that annual reading tests send to teachers about how they should teach kids to read. And I could, at deathless length, explain to you how that's really creating, almost incentivizing, bad practice. So there's two things I would argue that have to happen. And you know, this is my third broad brush alert. One, we have to really rethink the messages that we're sending to teachers and schools through short-term incentives, through test-driven accountability. I'm not anti-test. Let me make that really, really clear. I want to know how my kid's doing. I want to know how your kid's doing. I want to know how schools and districts are doing. But that's not the same thing as we want you to get test scores up right now, because that's more complicated. So that's the policy play, is to really rethink what we're telling teachers functionally to do. To your very good point, can that happen at the national level? No, absolutely not. Can it happen on the state level? Well, it depends on what the policy is. I'm very optimistic about charter schools. I've taught in charter schools. I'm staunchly pro-charter. As long as the policy conditions are in place that allow, you know, genuine innovation, genuine experimentation, and smart teaching and learning, then I think you've got something. But you know, there's almost like a perfect storm that's conspired against that. You know, we could talk about ed school at length and the way I was taught to teach literacy to kids that does, you know, every kid I've taught has been a low-income kid of color. Many of the ideas that I now make fun of them simply are demonstrably bad. That's got to stop. You know, we need to create the conditions that allow teachers and schools to make long-term investments, so to speak, in background knowledge. I'm an unapologetic disciple of E.D. Hirsch Jr., who you might know of, who wrote Cultural Literacy. I always say he was the one guy whose work described what I was seeing in my South Bronx classroom every day. So you've got to create the conditions that allow for that patient investment in background knowledge and vocabulary, and don't just, you know, put a dipstick into the engine once a year and say, oh, how you doing? No, not enough progress since last year. Because as Hirsch himself says, language is a slow growing plant. It may not respond to short-term incentives.
Robert Pondicio, he is senior fellow at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to loosen government restrictions on craft distilleries. They're winning praise for their efforts from Pete Barger. He's principal owner of Southern Distilling Company in Statesville. He's also president of the State Distillers Association.
It's really a common sense provision. This is, at the end of the day, an employment bill. It's a business growth bill. This is about supporting industry and employing people in the state of North Carolina and contributing to the tax base in North Carolina. Today, we're still a fledgling industry, but we've come a long way in a few years. There's 77 permitted distilleries in North Carolina. While we're growing, you have to remember, we are small, family-grown, family-run organizations that have made significant investments in capital equipment. And it takes years for those investments to pay off in this business, such is the nature of this business. But we are also uniquely tied to this community, or to the communities that we operate in. That's because we are sourcing our local products, our grains, etc., from local farmers and growers. To put this in perspective, Southern Distilling Company, every eight-hour shift, we use 10,000 pounds of locally sourced grain. At any point in time, we have 2,000 acres of grain in contract production within a five-mile radius of our facility. So not only as we grow are we employing more people directly, But we're probably employing three times the number of people indirectly because of the rural and agrarian nature of our business. And I think that we can all agree North Carolina is still a rural and agrarian state, and anything that we can do to help support those industries is a benefit. SB 290 simply provides the market access and the additional revenue critical to grow our businesses and to hire more employees and to continue to support the state of North Carolina through federal excise taxes, state excise taxes, et cetera.
Pete Barker of the State Distillers Association also compared rules for spirits to those for beer and wine.
This is really an alcohol parity or equity bill. You know, a precedent has already been established with beer and wine, and quite frankly, we're just looking to the same access to consumers and markets that our friends in beer and wine have enjoyed. Look at these industries 15 years ago. They were just like we are today, small fledgling industries. Today, they're economic drivers in many communities that desperately need that income. We want to be a part of that growth. And to do that, we really need your support. So we're engaged, invested members in our communities. We believe that we can responsibly grow these businesses, but need your support to do so.
That's Pete Barger of Statesville, president of the Distillers Association of North Carolina. He's speaking in support of a bill to loosen state government restrictions on craft distilleries. The measure would grant distilleries more freedom in selling their products. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Among the most controversial pieces of legislation this year at the North Carolina General Assembly, a bill requiring the state's sheriffs to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement agents. In the state Senate, Republican Chuck Edwards made the case for the new requirement.
I'd like to begin with these words. Please listen to these carefully. I do solemnly swear that I will support and maintain the Constitution and the laws of the United States. I do solemnly swear that I will support and maintain the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Members, that's the first line in the oath that every sheriff in North Carolina has taken when they took their office. I want you to know and be clear that most North Carolina sheriffs eagerly cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In spite of this oath, there have been a few sheriffs that have refused to cooperate with ICE. They won't honor ICE detainers. And they won't allow ICE to interview detainees when that detainee is in their jail. It's all of our jobs to protect our citizens.
Edwards responded to the bill's critics.
I've listened to feedback from a lot of folks and asked myself, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing something that is constitutional? Are we making a decision that is humanitarian? And I've really questioned whether or not this bill does that, and I've come to the conclusion that it does all of those things. And we've heard from many citizens groups. Some were frightened, some angry. Almost all of them really not fully understanding what this bill does. We've heard from some sheriffs, one on behalf of the Sheriff's Association that strongly supports the bill. We've heard from a couple that oppose the bill. I'm convinced that this action is the right thing to do. If we are clear about who we should protect, criminals or law-abiding citizens.
Edwards recapped the bill's primary purpose.
It will require local law enforcement to work with federal immigration officials in the interest of public safety. Nothing else. It will protect law-abiding citizens from repetitious criminals. It will support all the law enforcement officers that are out there risking their lives daily to help ensure that our lives go uninterrupted by crime.
Edwards pushed back at those who complain about ICE, the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency.
What we're talking about is cooperating with an organization that's trying to protect us, our citizens, our sovereignty, our nation. Let's let those things sink in for just a minute. And let's keep in mind that there are people in this country illegally that want to hurt us. There are people in this country illegally that would want to hurt my granddaughter through either some terrorism act, through selling some substance that she would put in her veins, or some other means. And we can say that about the families of every member in here.
That's Republican Senator Chuck Edwards supporting a bill to require North Carolina sheriffs to cooperate with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. On the other side of the argument, Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick of Durham County.
Not a single sheriff in this state, not a single one out of the 100 counties, has violated a single law, a single rule, a single regulation as it relates to ICE and cooperation with ICE. It is within the inherent authority of each sheriff who is duly and lawfully elected from all of the people within those counties to decide whether they want to work with ICE or decide whether not to work with ICE. That's within their authority. That's within their discretion today, and that's the way it should remain. When we look at some of the languages in this bill, we go far, far astray, and it's going to have a very chilling impact on many people in this state. It's going to intimidate many people in this state, many people who already live in fear underneath a shadow and underneath a cloud. We should be about making certain that in this state that everybody, regardless of where they came from, feels that they can have confidence in law enforcement and call law enforcement, whether they're a victim of domestic violence, whether they're a victim of a crime, of a robbery, regardless of what that type of offense might be, that might have been perpetrated against them. Not to be fearful. Not to be unduly concerned.
McKissick challenges the notion that ICE detainers will target only the worst criminal offenders.
It could be a jaywalking offense. It could be a simple trespassing offense. It could be a simple traffic offense. If they end up going down to the county jail, now we have a law that says that sheriff or those law enforcement officers and personnel must, absolutely must, query ICE. They must do it. And what must they do otherwise? They got to wait and see what occurs with ICE. And establishes a parallel system, that same type of parallel system that's unconstitutional. A parallel system that essentially says, now, if we get information back with ICE, we have a judge, a magistrate, who's going to sit here and conduct a hearing and establishes a detainer process independent from federal law to hold someone for 48 hours. I'd like to remind you, the original bill said 96 hours. I guess you brought it back to 48 because you felt at least that would be consistent with what ICE would do under federal standards. But remember, you can't go out there and create a parallel system. And then it sits there and says that that person who's being detained, ICE can come and interrogate them. ICE can come in. And this is the process we're now establishing. Under normal law, a person goes before a magistrate. A magistrate looks at their criminal record. They look at the offense of which they're charged. They determine if they're a threat, and they determine if they can be released immediately or if there's a modest bond that allows them to be released. But no, we're establishing a whole new set of standards, which in my mind are clearly unconstitutional.
Republican Senator Chuck Edwards had a response for the critics.
I'm going to read another oath to you. I do solemnly and sincerely swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States, that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to the state of North Carolina and to the constitutional powers and authorities which are or may be established for the government thereof. Members, that came from the oath that every one of us took earlier this year. If you expect our sheriffs to live up to their oath, if you were truthful when you took your oath, if you believe in the rule of law, if you believe in the sanctity of this nation, if you believe in the very essence of your role as a lawmaker and that the laws you pass should be followed, if you believe we should protect our citizens instead of criminals, please join me in voting yes.
You've been listening to highlights from debate over a bill to require North Carolina sheriffs to work with federal immigration enforcement agents. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Governor Roy Cooper's veto of the bipartisan state budget passed by the General Assembly has again focused attention on North Carolina's decision to date not to expand Medicaid to another 500,000 to 600,000 adults. Now, the governor and other advocates are staunch supporters of the Medicaid expansion approach, but the John Locke Foundation's healthcare policy analyst says that would be the wrong move to make. Jordan Roberts joins us now. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You have written a lot about this issue, and in a letter to the editor of the Wilmington Star News, that editorial board had endorsed Medicaid expansion. You wrote that legislators are right to reject what you say would be an estimated $6 billion expenditure over 10 years. Mm-hmm. Why are they right to reject Medicaid expansion?
Well, for a number of reasons, but I think the most important reason that you got to look at first is the costs. And there's two aspects to the costs that we're, you know, concerned about here at the John Locke Foundation. First of all, the way that the Affordable Care Act was set up, the federal government would pay for 90% of the state Medicaid expansion, program. And what we're concerned about is with the state of the federal government, $22 trillion in debt, approaching $1 trillion a year of deficit that, you know, is the federal government going to be able to keep that promise of paying 90%? And you look at some of these other social programs like Medicare and Social Security, and that just, it's a bleak outlook. And so, you know, we're concerned that if we commit to covering, you know, up to 138% of the federal poverty line through our state Medicaid program, that, you know, at any time the money could be ripped out from under us. And, you know, that's just, I think, a chance that the North Carolina General Assembly shouldn't take. And on the other side, when you inject more federal money into the healthcare system, it's a massive market distortion, and, you know, costs can rise for private insurers because of private insurance crowd out. Medicaid reimburses below what it normally costs to provide care. So sometimes you have large hospital systems, having to make up for that in some way. So, you know, there's a big reason for costs. Another reason is that, you know, here in North Carolina, we have about 10 million people in our state population, and we already have a little over 2 million people already on the Medicaid rolls, and we've added 500,000 just in the last couple of years while the economy has been growing. And so, you know, there's no shortage of problems in our current Medicaid program. So when you look at all that, you look at the growth of the program, it just doesn't make fiscal sense to add, you know, another 500,000 to 600,000 people, potentially getting close to 3 million, a third of our states, or, you know, just below a third of our state's population to the Medicaid program when, you know, the scope of this program is for the neediest in our state.
Jordan, what I have found really compelling about some of the writing that you've done on this issue is not only the fiscal impacts that you've just described, but you talked a lot, or you wrote about how current enrollees in the Medicaid program, people who really do fit the qualification, they're poor, they're disabled, mm-hmm. they really do need the social safety net, that some of those folks would find themselves crowded out, essentially not able to access care that they need because so many new people would be added into the system. Talk a little bit more about that.
Right. So, you know, when it comes down to it in North Carolina, we have, you know, medical deserts. We have shortages of primary care physicians, mental health professionals in a lot of areas of our state. And so, you know, the traditional Medicaid population sometimes can already struggle to find doctors who are in their area, or if they are in their area, who actually accept Medicaid or accept new Medicaid patients. So, you know, with that shortage problem, adding a whole another 500,000 people to the rolls, that really could have an effect on people's ability to seek care through the Medicaid program. And that's not to say that we don't want these people to seek care. It's just that, you know, we know that this could have an effect on people's ability to get into the doctor. And, you know, that because of Medicaid's lower reimbursement rates, some doctors aren't willing to accept that. So that comes back to the point that, you know, health insurance doesn't mean you have access to health care. And so, you know, addressing those accessing, you know, problems first, that's the right step instead of just expanding government coverage to people who may not be able to access a doctor.
You know, some people will say, well, wait a second, Jordan Roberts, that all sounds great, but it sounds very academic. And, you know, why wouldn't you want to try to help people? But you've also written that just because you oppose Medicaid expansion doesn't mean that you don't care, and doesn't mean that there isn't a real problem. There are people
right.
who really can't access affordable health insurance. So what do we do instead if not expand Medicaid?
Right. And, you know, that's at the crux of the disagreement between those on the left and the right here. You know, here at the John Locke Foundation, we have seen what, you know, 50 plus years of government intervention in our healthcare markets has done. Prices continue to go up. And the answer seems to be, from a lot of people, more government regulation, more government spending, more government control of healthcare. And that's just not how we see, you know, the correct fix to this market. And, you know, like I was talking about before, we need more, a higher supply of healthcare. So there's a number of supply side reforms that we can take in the state to increase the number of low cost facilities, the number of health professionals in the area. And, you know, when you have downward pressure because of increased supply, you know, that's how we can, you know, lower the cost of health insurance, be that through an employer plan, through the Obamacare exchanges. You know, there's lots of laws in North Carolina that we can change. Just a few off the top of my head. Certificate of need laws. We've talked about that on here before. Opening up the freedom of nurse practitioners to practice without supervision requirements. Expand the use of telemedicine by letting people with in good standing with licenses outside of the state see patients inside of the state. Join these licensure compacts that make it easier for licensed professionals to come in. You know, other insurance options like association health plans that a lot of these workers that aren't full-time employees working for a company that provides an employer plan, that maybe through a trade association they could get coverage. And, you know, so there's plenty of options, and we know that more government intervention, more government spending, more government control is not the answer that's going to bring down prices. You know, instead it just shifts the cost to the taxpayer by expanding these government programs that now provide coverage to people who can't afford it. And, you know, a large part of the reason it's unaffordable is because of the Affordable Care Act, all these regulations that got placed on insurance markets, what insurers have to cover. So So, you know, we've seen the evidence when the government gets involved that, you know, the prices for healthcare keep going up, insurance becomes less competitive, less affordable for a lot of folks. And then that's when we arrive at this answer where a lot of people say, you know, the only other option is to expand Medicaid, and that's not the way we see it.
And it looks like momentum to expand Medicaid across the country actually is slowing. A recent story in Governing Magazine talked about North Carolina and other states that have not expanded Medicaid and says that, you know, there was a time when state after state was starting to sign on to the program and saying, yes, we're going to take that federal money. We're going to go ahead and expand. But they've had some experiences in other states that will give states like North Carolina pause before we would act that way. So why is momentum slowing then?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of states that see the trajectory of the federal budget, and there's a promise of 90% of the costs. And here in North Carolina, that our state share would be roughly $600 million over the first 2 years. So in total, that's about, you know, $5.4 billion being promised by the federal government. And if we commit to that, open up our Medicaid program to cover these folks, and the federal government would, you know, somehow take that money away, North Carolina General Assembly budget makers would have to make that up somehow, and that comes from, you know, crowding out other parts of the budget, cutting services for current Medicaid recipients, or, you know, raising taxes to fill that hole.
We've been talking about the debate over whether or not to expand Medicaid in North Carolina. Jordan, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.